Welcome to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hartwick. We start with the Michigan House finishing its investigation into the Larry Nassar scandal. Nassar, a former physician, was sentenced to decades in prison after sexually abusing dozens of girls and women while at Michigan State University and USA Gymnastics. He is now imprisoned in Arizona on child pornography charges. Joining me now to talk about the House report is Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth.
Hello, thank you for having me.
What did we learn from the state lawmakers?
We actually learned quite a bit. So to give a little bit of a history, this is an inquiry that was started back in January. The lawmakers who are heading this are Republican Representative Clint Kesto and Republican Representative Kim Lasada. They are members of two different House committees, the Committee on Law and Justice, and then a House Appropriations Committee. So they're the ones that have really been spearheading this investigation. And around February, they received thousands of pages of documents from MSU, and their request was for documents surrounding the Larry Nassar case, particularly starting in 2014 onward. And some of the things that we learned from this, one, from 2014 to the present, at least 243 survivors reported abuse by Larry Nassar to the MSU Police Department. And we also learned that most of the survivors were minors at the time. And while many of the survivors were gymnasts, there were some that were not gymnasts. So this is kind of giving us another lens to look at the scope of Larry Nassar's abuse. Some of the other things that we learned, basically where MSU went wrong in handling Larry Nassar. The report or the letter that the committee members sent to the Speaker of the House, essentially it says, without a doubt to them, that MSU mishandled a Title IX investigation in 2014. And that is essentially an internal investigation by the college into claims of abuse against Nassar that was filed by one of his former patients.
Interesting. So where do we go from here? Because I know there are a lot of bills that the lawmakers are considering right now.
Yes. So this inquiry comes as multiple bills have been introduced. There was a big Senate package that passed in the Senate and is now waiting for a committee hearing in the House. And that package is kind of focused on essentially, as they would say, justice for victims kind of after the fact. So it's focused on, you know, who is required to be mandatory reporters, extending that definition. It also focuses on timelines and statute of limitations, expanding the length of time that survivors have to file civil actions against either institutions or individuals, and also file criminal complaints and extending the time limits that they have for those situations. The report itself has about, you know, over 30, I believe, recommendations for things that can be changed. And some of those are bills that have already been enacted, including making it a crime to use one's position of authority over another to prevent that person from reporting criminal sexual conduct. It also recommends expanding the mandatory reporter law to cover coaches and athletic trainers, as well as physical therapists. As I mentioned, those are bills that have already been introduced. But some of the other kind of major areas where they want to see reform, bills that haven't been introduced yet, involve Title IX. So one of them is to create a Title IX ombudsman in the Department of Civil Rights to more comprehensively provide means to justice for students on college campuses. And there's a couple other recommendations surrounding Title IX. What they're getting at there is there needs to be more oversight of college Title IX departments. They're saying that it's not enough that you have this sort of internal investigation, because even a Title IX department might be biased and might get it wrong because they're looking at people they know, a college that they work for. So they want to see more oversight of those Title IX departments, including reviews by third parties of college campus Title IX departments.
What other investigations are going on here in the state?
In the state, we've still got the Attorney General's investigation, which, as I'm sure a lot of people know, has already resulted in charges against another individual at MSU, former Dean William Strample. He is facing multiple charges, including a felony, and in part for, you know, failure to oversee Larry Nassar after this Title IX investigation that they're talking about. And also when it comes to the House, you know, they're saying that this really doesn't end their inquiry. There's, you know, these are the findings that they have as a result of reviewing all of these documents and getting questions answered by MSU. But really, this is kind of a midway point for them. They plan to introduce a lot of legislation. And when they introduce legislation and start to move the legislation, there's going to be a lot of testimony. So they're really focusing on, you know, what are some policies that we can put in place? What are some bills that we can put in place? And while we're going through the process of bills that are already out there and new bills, we're going to be hearing testimony to see, is this the right course of action? Should we scale back? Should we do more? Should we do something, you know, come at this from a completely different angle? So we are definitely not through with hearing about Larry Nassar and hearing about legislation coming from this Larry Nassar case. And we're definitely not done with inquiries into MSU.
And we should also mention nationally, there are about three congressional investigations, as well as one started by the Department of Education.
Yep.
Well, we know you're staying on top of all of this. That is Capitol correspondent Shayna Roth.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. Three former Michigan State University football players accused in the 2017 sexual assault of a woman in an apartment bathroom pleaded guilty to reduced charges Wednesday. WKAR's Katie Cook reports on the charge that surprised many.
Josh King, Donnie Corley Jr., and Demetric Vance pleaded guilty to seducing an unmarried woman. Ingham County Prosecutor Carol Seaman says the seduction charge is sometimes used in situations where a defendant may not be willing to plead to a charge that would result in requiring them to register as a sex offender.
This case, while it's an unusual plea, because seduction is not a statute that I'm fond of, it's very archaic, it's not unusual that we give individual attention to cases and come up with individual responses based on the circumstances of that case. So we have, in this instance, there's a plea to a five-year felony, which would result in a significant amount of probationary time and oversight.
The agreement also calls for no upfront jail time for the three defendants. Sentencing is scheduled for June 6th before Judge Rosemary Aquilina. If Judge Aquilina decides to include jail time as part of the sentencing, the defendants can withdraw their guilty pleas. For WKAR News, I'm Katie Cook.
Hearing that it is a felony to seduce an unmarried woman in Michigan in 2018 caught many people by surprise. The charge dates back to 1931. We wanted to know, what does that mean in modern times? Chris Burtley is a litigation lawyer based in Detroit, and he talked with current sports host Al Martin to discuss the plea agreement for the former MSU players.
So such an old statute that even as the prosecutor herself said that the law is archaic and it comes from a bygone era, and it certainly sounds like that the way that it's written. So it is a tool, and she described it as a tool, and it can be used if necessary. But I'd like to give an overview of some of the process of how we got here.
Yeah, please.
If I can, Al.
Yeah.
So I think most citizens and probably most of your listeners' experience with police are tend to happen, you know, maybe at a traffic stop or something when they get pulled over, and the police may see an act that's in the current of going on, right? But a lot of times police aren't involved in investigating accusations of things that happened in the past. And that makes their role largely investigative. And they have to interview witnesses, they have to gather evidence, and they're putting together the pieces of what happened and trying to see if the activity that they've been tipped off to or that they've been referred to violates a criminal statute. And after they gather all of that evidence, they take a look at it, and they decide whether a warrant is going to be issued. And they take a look at certain penal codes, and they decide whether the activity that the person that they're investigating violated it. And they'll turn that over to the prosecutor's office, and the prosecutor's office will decide whether they're going to press charges against the individual. Now, you know, it's a separate investigation and determination that the prosecutor makes on whether charges should be filed. I'm sure your listeners may remember in the Adrian Payne and Keith Appling case, there were charges that the police suggested that the prosecutor charge, and they declined to charge. So you're going to have two separate determinations, whether the police think that it's appropriate that a charge be pressed against the individual, and then what the prosecutors are going to file. So here, once evidence was gathered by the police and turned over to the Ingham County prosecutor, they decided that it was appropriate against King, the first-degree sexual misconduct charge, and then Corley, of course, the third degree, and Vance, the third degree as well. And then, of course, King had a third-degree sexual misconduct and additional minor charge. So, you know, when you have those type of charges, it's the prosecutor has to take a look at what is the evidence support, because they have the responsibility to prove that the crime was committed beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's a very high standard. Mm-hmm. And so they're looking at the evidence. They're seeing what crimes do the evidence support. And they're going to look at what we say, do they prove the elements of each charge? And certain charges will have more difficult or more elements to prove.
This Penal Code Act, you know, 328 of 1931. How common have you seen seducing and debauching an unmarried female in your line of work?
Well, it's very dependent on the prosecutor, and Prosecutor Seaman's statement really touched on this a lot. I mean, she released a statement on the incident, and it really talked about her outlook and her progressive outlook on sentencing, and she described it as a tool, and she says it's one that is I'm paraphrasing now, but isn't commonly used, but it's consistently used by prosecutors, and they have a lot of leeway and a lot of deference in deciding how they prosecute cases and how they're going to use the tools at their disposal. So, you know, certain prosecutors wouldn't use this and wouldn't have done this route, and other prosecutors would have, and it's really dependent upon the certain prosecutors. So, you know, it's something that maybe a different prosecutor in her shoes wouldn't have wanted to plead down to that, but maybe others would. And I think what's really key about the plea deal and the seduction charge is that it's a charge that doesn't require registering for the sexual offender registry in Michigan. Mm-hmm. That allows the three young men in this case to be eligible for the Holmes Youthful Trainee Act. And that's very key here, you know, which allows them to go to school, gives them an ability to basically expunge their record, which is if they comply with all the elements of their parole that the judge will assign to them to basically get their record sealed and move on with their lives. And having the consent of the survivor, like I said, is very key here, because it seems like a middle ground that all the parties were able to come to and allow them to reenter society and continue with school and be reformed at the key end of it, not just punished.
That was Detroit-based litigation attorney Chris Burtley talking with current sports host Al Martin about three former Michigan State University football players once accused of sexual assault, but now pleading guilty to the charge of seducing an unmarried woman. From Memphis to Michigan, remembering Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
Dr. King and his message, it always embodied hope and the belief that America is the America that it says it is.
That's in our next segment. And later, ways to keep you and your family safe in the upcoming severe storm season.
Over the last several years, we've seen our fair share of tornadoes.
Plus, getting rid of those stink bugs that have invaded our houses here in Michigan. You're listening to Current State on WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region.
But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right. And so just as I say, we aren't gonna let any dogs or water hoses turn us around, we aren't gonna let any injunction turn us around.
Welcome back to Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Reginald Hardwick, and you are listening to a portion of the I've Been to the Mountaintop speech given a day before Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated on April 4th, 1968, 50 years ago this week. Just days ago, from Memphis to Michigan, people reflected on Dr. King's life and legacy, and we're going to do the same thing right now, starting with comments from the Reverend Jesse Jackson, who was with King in Memphis before he was killed, and returned to the Lorraine Motel to make these comments about King's dream today.
As in the biblical case, he is not here, he's gone. When you celebrate Barack winning the campaign in 2008 and 12, he's alive. When those children marched last week saying ban assault weapons, enough of guns is enough, he's alive. When we walked and marched and freed Mandela, he's alive. He was lied on, spat upon, turned on, violated, and yet somehow, some way, he would not give up.
On the day after King's assassination 50 years ago, students at Michigan State University marched. And to honor Dr. King, they marched again last week. NWKAR's Karel Vega was there.
The march was organized by Dr. Robert L. Green, who led the first MLK march on MSU's campus the day after King was assassinated in 1968. About 24 people gathered for today's march at MSU, including Theodore Ransaw, a faculty member at MSU's James Madison College. Ransaw was born in 1968, not long after King was assassinated. He says this march is a representation of MSU's history of being impactful to civil rights.
About the summer before Dr. King's assassination, Dr. Green had taken some students down from MSU to do some work in the South and some reading programs, black and white students. So MSU has actually done a lot with regards to social justice, and I guess not too many people may know that.
Fighting through strong winds and the occasional blast of snow, the marchers walked from the Spartan statue to Beaumont Tower, sending a message, according to Ransaw, that people have not forgotten about Dr. King's fight for justice over 50 years ago. Karel Vega, WKAR News.
Time is running out. If you want to view an exhibit of artwork and artifacts examining Dr. King's life at the East Lansing Hanna Community Center. Recently, I talked with Elaine Hardy, chairperson of the Greater Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Commission, about the exhibit and what Dr. King's dream means to her.
What we have on exhibit are some artistic interpretations of prints that are of iconic images from the civil rights movement. So you'll see images from Selma, you'll see images from Birmingham, you'll see images from Montgomery, you'll see images from Atlanta. And what we're hoping to do is tell the story of Martin with those images in a chronological order from the time he emerged on the scene as the civil rights leader through his assassination and then up until his birthday was recognized as a national holiday.
Why is it important to share these images and Dr. King's message at this time in 2018?
Well, I think that his message is relevant for us. One of the things that I always tell my children and anyone that I have an opportunity to is that he had a tremendous audacity in him to believe in the credo of this country, to say, listen, we are all Americans, we all are equal. And he didn't live in a time when that was the truth. He couldn't get on a bus anywhere he wanted to. He couldn't go eat anywhere he wanted to. He couldn't go to school anywhere he wanted to. And for him to have the audacity to believe that and bring a whole nation along with him and then bring a whole world along with him, his message is relevant today. We see renewed challenges to voting rights. We see a climate in this country that is not as inclusive as it could be. But one of the things about Dr. King and his message, it always embodied hope and the belief that America is the America that it says it is. And Reggie, I have to tell you that when I was born, there was no provision in the United States Constitution that protected my right to vote. And I had in my lifetime the opportunity to vote for an African-American president and a woman president. I believe in that America that Dr. King believed in. I know that tomorrow might be hard for some of us. I know that we are looking at renewed challenges, but I believe that there is a better day. And I know that because I know Americans, I know my neighbors, and I know that we will always search to be a good place to be for everyone. I know that we'll always search in ourselves for our better angels. And I know that we believe in the higher ideals of our country. And so when I think about Dr. King and the relevance of his message of social justice, inclusion, and making certain that everyone is counted, I know that it's relevant for everyone today. And I still believe in that America. And I still believe in his dream.
You are listening to Elaine Hardy, chairperson of the Greater Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Holiday Commission, talking about an exhibit of artwork and artifacts on the life of Dr. King.
You can see that exhibit at the East Lansing Hanna Community Center on Abbott Road until April 30th.
We shall not be moved. We shall not, be moved like a tree that's planted by the water. We shall not be moved.
You're listening to Current State from WKAR. One of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s closest friends was William G. Anderson, an osteopathic surgeon with Michigan State University who practices in Detroit. A few years ago, he sat down with WKAR's Kevin Lavery about how he came to meet and befriend Dr. King.
The way that happened, it is somewhat prophetic the way it happened, in that I met this lady who I eventually married, or I should say she eventually married me to my good fortune. She lived in Atlanta. She had a brother who was a classmate and a close friend of Martin Luther King Jr. Now, mind you, I'm not talking about the Right Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. I'm talking about M.L. King, high school student. My brother-in-law and Martin Luther King Jr. were the best of friends and both aspiring ministers. So when I married this lady, or she married me, then I got introduced to him as he was a student and I was a student.
Who was the Martin Luther King Jr. you knew as a colleague and a friend that the world did not know?
Martin, because of his relationship with my brother-in-law, spent as much time at my mother-in-law's home, and incidentally, I did stay at with my mother-in-law when I got married because I could not afford anything for myself, and I had a wonderful mother-in-law, by the way. But Martin would spend as much time at our home, her home, as at his own home. And he and my brother-in-law would practice that preaching. I describe it on several occasions as practicing that preaching ad nauseum. And I would tell him, why don't you just shut up? It was annoying. It's sort of like listening to a kid learn how to play a violin. How annoying can that be? Well, anyway, I did not come to fully appreciate how he was developing, and as he's matured and his preaching practicing became less and less annoying and more intriguing and inviting and invigorating.
If I lived in China or even Russia or any totalitarian country, maybe I could understand some of these illegal injunctions. Maybe I could understand the denial of certain basic First Amendment privileges because they haven't committed themselves to that over there. But somewhere I read of the freedom of assembly. Somewhere I read of the freedom of speech. Somewhere I read of the freedom of press. Somewhere I read that the greatness of America is the right to protest far right.
You don't realize that it's history when you're in the middle of it, and suddenly you realize that you've helped set in motion things that are bigger than yourself.
Yes, it's sort of like in one of the demonstrations, even Dr. King was not always certain that he would have the masses of people with him. And you're not thinking about history, right? You're not thinking about making history. You're thinking about how we can bring about this little change that we want in Montgomery. It was about riding on a bus. In Albany, it was about getting the right to vote. But you don't think that this is part of a bigger picture that will literally change the nation.
He stayed in your home for a while. Was he a good roommate?
We all admired and revered Martin Luther King Jr. He was, even though others might not have perceived him as such, many of us early on recognized him as the Messiah. And when he came to stay at our home, even my children, who were teens and sub-teens, were eager to give up their bedroom, give up a place at the table for him. So we had a small two-bedroom house. And of course, my wife and I gave up our bed, and there was no such thing as a king-size bed or queen-size bed. It was just a double bed. We gave up our bed for him. Martin was a man who was not demanding. In other words, he did not require a T-bone steak, filet mignon, and escargot. No, no, no. When he would come into my house, he and Abernathy both would go right to the kitchen, which was the place where people would congregate, and start lifting the covers off of pots to get some greens and peas and baked ham or fried chicken or whatever was there. They did not require, neither one, they did not demand any special attention. They came in and just joined with the other people.
So you and your wife and all the people affected in Albany began to realize that you had an obligation to break the law when the law was unjust.
That's correct. We knew we were breaking the law, demonstrating, protesting, picketing, when the law says you can't do that. You cannot do that without a permit. In other words, you cannot, they call it parade. You cannot parade without a permit, and they consider that a parade. And yes, and we also knew that there was not just a risk, but the reality of, if you do this, you're going to jail. Even then, I mean, it was heartening to me to see how many people were willing to do that on faith. And they sang, and they prayed, and they sang the songs of freedom that emanated from those jails. To hear those songs, nothing like it, nothing like it.
Do you recall which songs?
Oh, freedom. Before I be a slave, I'll be dead and in my grave. There were a lot of songs like that.
Ooh, freedom. Oh, freedom. Oh, freedom over me. And before I'd be a slave, I'd be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free.
Everybody. Do you remember the night Martin Luther King Jr. was killed? Certainly you do, but what was that for you?
That night, I turned on the television and I went to call him to urge him to come to Detroit to talk to some of these people who had been his supporters for years. But that night, I called his wife to try to get to him. And while I was on the phone talking to her, she said, "Wait a minute, Andy. Something has happened to Martin." She left the phone and never came back. I had the TV on, and of course, in a matter of minutes, they announced that he had been shot.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee. Police have issued an all-points bulletin for a well-dressed young white man seen running from the scene. Officers also reportedly chased and fired on a radio equipped car.
I don't smoke, I don't drink, but that night I went out and got myself a filthy liquor and a pack of cigarettes. And I guess I sat by the television all night smoking and drinking. I was wounded, as were many, many, many others.
It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
That was 45 years ago. Does it still hurt?
It still hurts. We are still looking for not necessarily another Martin Luther King Jr., but looking for someone who will pick up the mantle and maybe go in a different direction.
We've got some difficult days ahead. But it really doesn't matter with me now, because I've been to the mountaintop. I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And He's allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over. And I've seen the the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Dr. William G. Anderson is a doctor of osteopathic medicine with Michigan State University, working at Sinai Grace Hospital in Detroit, and a colleague, associate, and friend of the late Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. Anderson, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, one day, when the war is won, we will be sure.
The heavens, no man, no weapon formed against, yes, glory is destined. Everyday women and men become legends. Sins that go against our skin become blessings. The movement is a rhythm to us. Freedom is like religion to us. Justice is juxtaposition in us. Justice for all just ain't specific enough. One son died, the spirit is revisiting us. True and living, living in us. Resistance is us. That's why Rosa sat on the bus. That's why we walked through Ferguson with our hands up. When it go down, we woman and man up. They say stay down, and we stand up. Shots be on the ground, the camera panned up. King pointed to the mountaintop, and we ran up.
One day, when the glory comes, it will be ours, it will be ours. Oh, glory, glory, oh, glory, glory. Now the world.
Welcome back to Current State on WKAR. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. And next week is Severe Weather Awareness Week here in Michigan. And joining us now is WLNS 6 News meteorologist Erica Striva. Welcome to Current State.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I want to ask you first, what is the most common severe weather that we see here in Michigan?
What we usually see typically in a year, flooding is not usually common, but when it does happen, like we saw a couple months ago, things can get bad very quickly. Usually we start to see the most rain during the year over the next coming couple of months. And also we start to get into the bigger severe weather season, including tornadoes, large hail, more frequent thunderstorm activity, and also high winds within the coming months, actually.
I started with flooding because it's so deadly. What is the issue that makes it such a huge problem?
Occasionally, flooding can happen in a matter of a couple hours, especially if we have a lot of rain in such a short amount of time. And what we always talk about and try and hit home with is turning around if you approach roads that are covered in floodwater, because one, you never know how deep the floodwater is. And if it is deep enough, your car can get submerged and your car can get taken away by the current. And that puts you in incredible danger.
We've always had a history of tornadoes here, and even large track tornadoes here in Michigan. Tell me about that.
So over the last several years, you know, we've seen our fair share of tornadoes across Michigan. It's not uncommon to have several in the state. Now, they're usually spaced out a little bit more than the tornado outbreaks that you see down to the south. But, you know, we see severe weather starting to pick up in the month of April and getting actually more frequent as we head towards May, June, and July. That's usually our peak severe weather season across the area. But tornadoes, not uncommon. Some years we have less than double-digit tornadoes. Some years we have more than that. And it all honestly depends on the systems that come on through, and if they're strong enough to produce long track significant tornadoes, or if they're more minor ones. But again, we're not, it's not uncommon to see several tornadoes across the state of Michigan.
When we have a severe thunderstorm warning, what does that include?
So a severe thunderstorm warning can include anything from strong winds greater than 58 miles per hour, hail greater than quarter size, which is about an inch, and then could also include frequent lightning, heavy rainfall, not more specific to those damaging winds and large hail, but as the storms do roll through, heavy rain is also a potential factor. Lightning is also a potential factor. But even if we do have a severe thunderstorm warning, you never want to let your guard down because tornadoes can spin up very, very quickly. So you want to make sure you're inside and safe as that storm continues to push on through.
And then when a tornado warning is issued, what does that include, and what should people do?
So when a tornado warning is issued, that means there is a good sign that a tornado is likely going to form, whether on radar or whether they've seen damage being reported throughout that storm as it's passed through counties previously, or they've seen reports or heard reports that a tornado is on the ground. So you want to make sure you're in the lowest interior room, preferably a basement. But if you don't have a basement, make sure you go into a closet, a bathroom, anywhere away from windows, and make sure that you stay safe and let the storm move on through before you venture on out to see if any damage had occurred.
Another meteorologist friend of mine says being in a tornado is like being in a blender with razor blades, because really you have so much debris flying through.
Right.
And
right. Yeah. Make sure you're away from the windows in an interior room. If you have enough time to grab, you know, those pillows, maybe even some books to protect your head, you can definitely do that. But sometimes the storm is really, really close. If the tornado warning was just issued, that you may not have that much time, and you don't want to be worrying about that rather than getting into that interior room to stay safe. But we also talk about having a plan in place so that if a tornado warning is issued, and that you know if that a watch is issued, that you're prepared with that plan, that if a warning is issued, you have that plan in place, and you can make sure that all of those essential items are already in your interior room or in your basement, so that all you have to do is just go right into there and let the storm pass.
If you're in an office building, where should you go?
Make sure you get to the lowest floor. So if you're several floors above, make sure you get to the lowest floor. If you don't have enough time for that, just make sure you're away from windows. If there is a bathroom in the interior portion of the building on the floor that you're in, make sure you get to that. But if you have more time to do that, make sure you go to the lowest floor. That's going to be the safest place.
There is a statewide drill in a few days. So, Eric, what should people do when they hear the storm sirens?
So that that drill is on Wednesday. I believe it's at 1 p.m. And what you should do is the sirens are going to go off statewide. So treat it as an actual tornado warning. Get a plan in place. Make sure you have a plan in place before Wednesday, if you have time. And treat it as an actual tornado warning. So go into that interior room, go into the basement, wait a few minutes, make sure you take your family down there if the family is at home. I know it's during portions of the day where the kids will probably be at school. So the schools are all going to make sure that the kids know their tornado plan for all the schools, as they'll likely go into the hallways, bring out a book to cover your head, and they'll likely do the same thing across the schools statewide. But just make sure that if you can't do it during that time when the entire family gets home on that day, make sure that you guys sit down maybe during family dinner or at some point before everyone goes to bed and make sure that they know what the plan is if a tornado warning was to be issued.
And lastly, Eric, how are you talking about severe weather on 6 News?
This week's Weather Wednesday, we are touching on everything Severe Weather Awareness Week. And we will have graphics that we're going to be showing all next week. And also, if you miss this week's Weather Wednesday. It will be on WLNS.com.
Well, thank you, Eric Estrema. You can see him weekend mornings and evenings on WLNS 6 News. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back to Current State. Our next story has been viewed on WKAR.org thousands of times and shared hundreds of times on Facebook. Are you dealing with stink bugs at home? WKAR contributor Russ White spoke with MSU entomologist Howard Russell to learn more about the growing stink bug infestation in Michigan.
The one people are complaining right now about is the brown marmorated stink bug, and this is one that showed up in Michigan for the first time back in around 2010, and it was first found down in southwest Michigan, and since then it's been spreading throughout the lower peninsula.
Now, are they harmful to people or pets?
Not so much to people and pets. They're a pretty important plant pest that attack tree fruit, apples, peaches, and also they'll attack a lot of garden crops too, tomatoes and even some field crops, corn and soybeans. So we've yet to see a lot of damage in the fields as a result of this bug. They're most notorious right now because they invade homes in the fall of the year. And what they're doing there is just looking for some place to protected to spend the winter. So 4 or 5 years ago, I had complaints of people finding two or three in their homes during the winter. A couple years ago, maybe a dozen or so. But now I'm getting calls from people that see dozens in their home. And unfortunately, that trend is going to continue to go up. Out east where the bug has been around for a while, they shovel them off their front porches. So people can expect to see hundreds, if not thousands, in the next few years of these things on the outside of their homes.
So how do we control them? Can we control them?
Well, in terms of homeowners and keeping them out of their homes, I mean, there's things that they can spray in the fall of the year when they see them congregating on the outside of their homes. They can spray them at that point, and there's things that will kill them that people can buy at the local hardware store or Lowe's or some of the big box stores. Once they get in, though, it's a little more difficult. You can sweep them up. And, of course, they stink. As their name implies, they are stink bugs, so they have scent glands that give off a foul odor. Some people out east have found that traps, light traps, work pretty well, and the ones that you can make are as effective as the fancy ones that you can buy. And a light trap is simply an aluminum foil roasting pan that you would buy at the grocery store and fill it with a couple inches of soapy water and shine a desk lamp in it, and the bugs are attracted to the light and they'll crawl into the water and drown. If you were going to talk about, you know, a management strategy, it would be one to exclude them, do a thorough inspection in the fall of the year where they're congregating, and make sure those areas are tight, make sure your doors and windows are tight fitting. Sealing homes with vinyl siding is a little difficult because the siding isn't nailed tight to the home. Soffits and siding are, if it's vinyl, they're hung and it's loose and bugs can find ways around it. So sprays will help, and some people claim that dish soap and water is pretty effective. Of course, there's no residual. I mean, there's nothing left that will kill bugs as when it dries down. But once they get in, it's difficult to deal with them.
So when they're in, are there ways we can get rid of them other than just scooping them up and maybe flushing them? Or?
Well, that's probably the easiest way. People have used vacuums and to vacuum them up and get rid of them that way. People spray them and then clean up the dead ones or flush them down the toilet or whatever you want to do. You can use your own imagination as to how you get rid of them.
But I've heard they can make the vacuum smell too, so be careful.
And that's true with lady beetles too. So if you're going to vacuum them up, you might want to, next time you see one at a garage sale, an old vacuum, you might want to have one dedicated just for insect control.
So Howard, summarize for us what's important for us to know about stink bugs and dealing with them and their potential danger.
Well, they're not dangerous to us. They congregate on our homes in the fall of the year and find their way in, and once they do, you're likely to share their company all winter long. There are things that you can do on the outside of the house. You can spray insecticides to kill them before they get in. And once they're in, you can use a variety of methods to clean them up once they die, or you can use light traps, as I described. And if you have specific questions, you can contact me. My email address is bugman@msu.edu.
It's the first weekend of the month, and that means 90.5 Classical's new release of the month for April. WKAR station manager Peter Worf is your guide into this month's look at one of history's most deeply personal composers.
Composer Robert Schumann was streaky. He's famously known for devoting a single year to writing mostly songs, and another year was dominated by most of his best chamber music. Not so with his four symphonies, composed over the span of 10 years, with lots of fits and starts, second-guessing and reworking. Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony bring them all together in their newest release of Schumann's Complete Symphonies. Music director Tilson Thomas sums up Schumann's time and place alongside other Romantic-era greats like Frédéric Chopin, Franz Liszt, and Hector Berlioz.
These guys are kind of thrill seekers, and they love flouting convention, and they love really being in confrontation with society and all of its rules, and they love people knowing about all of the controversies surrounding their lives.
Schumann lived a dramatic life. He tried to pursue a career as a virtuoso pianist, but a hand injury ended that dream. He married his piano teacher's daughter, Clara Wieck, herself one of the greatest pianists of the day and a gifted composer. Schumann also suffered serious mental illness, alternating what was called exaltation and melancholy. He attempted suicide. His life ended in a mental institution. Like many great artists, Schumann's inner struggle was intense. And he didn't even start out to become one of history's finest and most personal composers.
He was a law student. And he was a law student, and in one of his diaries, he writes, "Tired of studying, something else coming up." And then next, he writes, "This week was the most debauched of my life." Shortly thereafter, he decided he was going to be either a poet or a musician, dropped out of law school.
And after that came all the piano and composing stuff. Early in his symphonic cycle was Schumann's most dramatic and original symphony, which actually came to be called the fourth and last. The new Schumann symphony recordings by the San Francisco Symphony and Michael Tilson Thomas are all live concert performances, adding that extra tightrope walk intensity. At the same time, Schumann's intimacy comes through.
You know, if you were out on a date with Wagner or Berlioz, they'd be saying, or Liszt, they'd be saying, "Hey, guess what? There's another club we could go to. Oh, there's another party that I know just the right people. If we say the right words, we can still get in. Oh, and there's a place where they do these things. Oh, it's unspeakable, but it's just the wildest thing. Oh, man." And in that context, Schumann would say, "Yeah, well, we could do that, but, you know, we could also go home. We could just go home. We could have such a nice time if the two of us just went home." And something of that really is in the warmth of his music.
Michael Tilson Thomas and the San Francisco Symphony's Schumann Symphonies, numbers 1 through 4, is WKAR's new release of the month for April. I'm Peter Worf.
Take a seat, right over there, sat on the stairs, stay or leave.
And that's it for this edition of Current State from WKAR, your NPR station for the Capital Region. I'm Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. For the entire WKAR news team, have a great weekend, and we'll connect with you next time.
I can't just let you go. Oh,
I'm losing.